Do I leave it just there? After a while?
Yeah, you can sit just there. It's fine. Okay, this interview is with Major James Costello, British Army and Canadian Army retired. At his house on Sinclair Road in Victoria, December the 6th, 1983. And the interview is by Morgan Wetzel. Okay, if I could then, when and where were you born?
I was born in Nottingham in England in 1920. My father was the vicar of St. Saviour's, Arkwright Street. We lived there for the next 7 years, and then we moved to Cumberland, where my father was vicar of a parish at a place called Silloth. And it was at Silloth that I spent most of my boyhood. I went to school at St. Bede's in Cumberland, and when I left school at the age of 18, I joined the British Army, and in 1940 was commissioned to the Border Regiment.
If I could ask, what prompted you to join the Army on leaving school? What made it attractive?
I had originally intended to join the Royal Navy, but when I took the exam, my marks weren't good enough for the Navy, but they were good enough for the Army, and so I went into the Army.
I take it then you joined as an enlisted man, not on any sort of commission training?
I joined as an enlisted man, that is true, but in those days, before the war, there was a scheme whereby you did 18 months in the ranks and then you went to Sandhurst.
Oh, I see.
But the war came before I had a chance to fulfill this aim.
So you would have spent the years over, I should think, the Munich crisis in that time then in the ranks of the Border Regiment?
No, I was... I didn't join until May 1939, and by then the Munich crisis was really over, and England was, like other places in Europe, was preparing for a war that seemed inevitable.
You were sure yourself that it was coming, were you, at the time you joined?
I wouldn't say that. I hoped it wouldn't come. I hoped it wouldn't come.
Yeah. And what happened then on the outbreak of war?
I was in Aldershot, England, at the outbreak of war. My battalion was sent to France within the first 4 or 5 days. I wasn't allowed to go to France because I was under the age of 19, and they had a rule then that anybody under the age of 19 could not go overseas in the British Army. And I was posted back up to the depot at Carlisle, and I was only there for a very short time, and I was sent to an officer training unit in Aldershot, back in Aldershot again, and there I stayed for the next 4 or 5 months until I was commissioned in March 1940.
Maybe you could sort of describe what the officer training at Aldershot was like, what it consisted of.
Well, it was a very shortened course, similar to the one that was held at Sandhurst, but took 18 months. It was fairly hard going, I suppose. We did weapon training, we did a certain amount of tactics, we did a certain amount of military law, a number of lectures on military history and that sort of thing, you know, the usual stuff, a certain amount of drill. One interesting thing that happened whilst I was a doctor was a visit by King George the Sixth, and he came and visited our OCCHU and spoke to many of the cadets, and I was one of the fortunate ones that spoke to him.
This would have been in what months?
This was in, I guess, February 1940.
And what did you really think of your chances of, or not your chances exactly, but your future in the military at that point? This was sort of the phony war, and everyone was wondering what was going to happen.
That's right. In fact, I was commissioned when the phony war broke in, I suppose it was May 1940, and the Germans came in through the Ardennes into France, and I was up in Carlisle at the time as a very junior officer, and It was a very, very exciting period, and of course we were extremely worried in England. I was immediately, when things got really bad, I was posted back down to Aldershot, and I was sent to one of the camps that were receiving the people who had managed to escape from Dunkirk, and you know, trying to look after them as best we could. It was interesting at that time, actually, because the chaps coming back from Dunkirk, the first people coming in were really in a dreadful state, I thought, and it was surprising that the last people coming in, which were mainly the old regiments like the Guards and the Rifle Brigade and what have you, they came in and they were in extremely good shape, mm-hmm. considering what they've been through.
Had kept their weapons and so on, much more, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It must have been a rather odd feeling for you, knowing that if you had been a little older, you would have been one of them, seeing as how your battalion was over there.
Indeed, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And then after Dunkirk was settled and you were stuck
then
in the
I was sent back to this OCTU as an instructor. I must have done too well as a cadet or something, but I was sent back to this OCTU as an instructor, where I stayed for the best part of 18 months, I guess. And then I was posted to the 1st Battalion of my regiment, which was then stationed in Llanelli in South Wales. And we did extensive training and exercises as part of one of these independent brigade groups. And I think it was 1942 that the 1st Airborne Division was formed or was conceived. And my brigade, of which the Border Regiment was part, was chosen to form the Air Landing Brigade of this Airborne Division. Now, to explain things a little bit more clearly to you, an Airborne Division consists of two parachute brigades and an Air Landing Brigade, plus various supporting arms. But the main fighting part of the brigade are the two parachute brigades, each of three parachute battalions, and the air landing brigade, which consisted of three, basically, infantry battalions. And these were chaps were carried in gliders, as opposed to the parachute brigades who jumped out of the aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
We moved to Hampshire, to a little village called Barton Stacey, and there the division was formed. The parachute brigades were at Bulford in Salisbury Plain, and the air landing brigade was in the Barton Stacey area.
Mm-hmm.
And we trained there fairly vigorously until 1943, when we were sent to North Africa to take part in the landings at Sicily, mm-hmm. in July 1943.
The training that you did it involve actually crashing gliders around the countryside and
oh yes,
passing debarking through?
Very much so. We flew in gliders quite a lot, really. I myself crashed in the damn things twice. First time was at Kidlington, just outside Oxford, and we were training in these small gliders called a Hotspur. There were seven of us in it, I think, and two pilots. And the pilots were, generally speaking, fairly inexperienced. Mm-hmm. And this chap made a beautiful landing on a ploughed field before he got to the airfield. And I was up at the front of the glider, just behind him, and I said, "Good God, what's going to happen now?" You see, and he said, "Don't worry." He said, "When we come to that brick wall, all I've got to do is pull the stick, and the thing will go over the wall, and we'll get onto the airfield." In fact, he pulled the stick back, and the glider didn't go up; it went through the brick wall. And he broke both his legs, I think, but the extraordinary thing was the glider disintegrated completely and nobody else was hurt at all. The second time was at a place called Tarrant Rushton, which was near Bournemouth, and here again we had another rather inexperienced pilot, and he had a larger glider called the... what the name of the damn thing now? anyway, carried about 30 men. The hawser carried about 30 men. And he was told to land at one flag that was placed on the ground and be able to pull up by the next flag, which was only a matter of a couple of hundred yards away, you see. So he had to come in extremely steeply, touch down, and then hopefully the glider would stop. Well, he made the most beautiful landing, but unfortunately it was about 50 feet above the ground, and the aircraft stalled, or the glider stalled, and we came down like a pancake, and the glider, the wings dropped off, and it broke in two, and really rather a mess. But nobody got hurt, strange to say.
When you were made into an air landing unit, was your armament changed at all? Was the unit's armament changed, or it was still
the establishment was changed, basically, and yes, indeed. We had to get rid of all our heavy vehicles. Everything had to be carried in a glider, so we were basically reduced to jeeps and trailers were the main sort of vehicles. The largest weapon we had at that time was a 6-pounder anti-tank gun.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, of course, we got the 17-pounder with the bigger glider, but we had the 6-pounder anti-tank gun, and that was the biggest weapon we had. And everything went in this Hawser glider.
Mm-hmm.
And one glider could carry one jeep and one trailer, or one jeep and one gun, or something like that.
How about smaller automatic weapons? Do they give you more of those?
Well, I think that we've probably got a larger share of the Sten gun. The Bren gun allotment was the same. There was one per section, the same as an infantry battalion. We had more mortars. We had a mortar platoon in the support company, but we also had two 3-inch mortars with each rifle company, which of course later on became general in the infantry, but at that time it was rather exceptional. Apart from that, it was basically an infantry battalion, and there wasn't an awful lot of difference, but the morale of the men was good, and they were shall we say rather picked men, and if they didn't want to do it, they could always volunteer to go elsewhere, and there was no compunction to stay with an airborne unit if you didn't wish to.
Did many men leave once the...
None at all. No. The morale was extremely high.
Everybody wanted to.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, at the end of this training then, I suppose you would have had a fairly clear role of what you were supposed to do in the event of an actual airborne
action. Oh yes,
action.
I think the standard of training of the... certainly the lower level training was extremely high. I've never seen anything like it. I mean, the men were very highly trained.
Mm-hmm.
We did a tremendous number of field firing exercises, far more so than you ever see done in peacetime.
Mm-hmm.
Live ammunition was used on many, many of our training exercises to an extent that in peacetime would be completely
mm-hmm.
forbidden. You wouldn't be allowed to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You're too dangerous. The result was that we did have some accidents, and people did get hurt, and some people got killed, unfortunately, but this is war, I suppose, and this is what goes on. But by the time we went to Sicily, I think we had a fairly highly trained organisation, and it was only unfortunate that when we did went to go to Sicily, the weather was dreadful. The pilots who towed us were mainly American and very inexperienced. We flew by night, and the result was that I guess 80% of the battalion were dropped in the sea.
Mm-hmm.
And the few that managed to get to the objective in Sicily at Syracuse, the bridge just south of Syracuse, were able to hold it and defeat the Italians that were holding it, until the sea-borne troops landed in the morning and took over from them. So although only 20% of the battalion managed to get to the objective, they certainly achieved what we set out to do.
But casualties, of course, because of dropping at sea, were of course very
high. Yeah, high casualties. People drowned and lost at sea, yes. In my particular case, the glider came down about 10 o'clock at night. We were about, I guess, 3 or 4 miles out at sea
mm-hmm.
from the shore. And we managed to sit on the wing of the glider and keep afloat until about 3 o'clock in the morning or thereabouts, I guess. And then the glider began to sink, and I decided, I was the senior officer on this little glider, it was only 14 men, that those who could swim, and there were about half a dozen of them, thought they could swim pretty well, and I had a subaltern with me, a younger officer, and I said he could go with the 6 men and try to swim ashore, and I'd stay with the fellows who couldn't swim. And so they pushed off, and in fact they were picked up in the morning before they got ashore, except for one man, and he, one of them, a strong swimmer, got ashore, but as soon as he got ashore he stepped on a landmine and got a leg blown off, which was unfortunate.
Yeah.
But the other chap got picked up. My people all managed, we managed to keep each other going, although they couldn't swim. We had these little May West things that went round that were sufficient to keep you afloat if you did a little bit of paddling as well. And we were picked up in the morning, and we were put aboard a ship called the Sobieski, which was one of the troop ships with landing craft on it. And there we were given a marvellous breakfast of bacon and eggs. We hadn't seen bacon and eggs because we'd been living under canvas in the desert for the last 2 or 3 months, I suppose, and the first decent food we'd seen for a long time, and it was absolutely marvellous. But anyway, the orders came round that we were not to be put ashore, that we were to be sent back to Malta to reform our battalion for another operation, you see. So eventually we all went back to Malta, and there we were put in a transit camp, and eventually we went back to North Africa, and the battalion was reformed, ready for the next little show.
So, with the exception of the fellow who stepped on a landmine, your platoon actually came through it without casualties?
That's right. Yeah. I was then in a recce platoon. I wasn't in a rifle platoon, and the recce platoon was organized in a rather different way. Each section was commanded by a lieutenant, and the section was 8 men.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a captain who was the recce platoon commander, and that was my job at the time. I was the recce platoon commander.
Mm-hmm. Did you know you were coming down in the sea before you actually hit?
Yes, the pilot warned us that we were ditching as we were coming down. And we don't really know the reason for it, but a certain amount of flak was coming up, which was, you could see it very clearly.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe the co-pilot got a bit worried.
Mm-hmm.
In any case, there was a telephone line between the tow plane and the glider, you see, along the hawser.
Mm-hmm.
And he normally was the chap who gave the instruction, the pilot of the tow plane, to the glider pilot when to cast off, you see, and he may have given it too soon, I don't know, but there was a very strong offshore wind.
Mm-hmm.
Which also made things difficult.
I understand that the parachute units were also scattered very,
all
very
over
badly.
The place.
Yeah.
But they didn't come in till 2 nights later.
Yeah.
They went to Catania, further north.
Oh, that's right, yeah, that's right. So the next operation then would have been the Salerno landings?
No. The next one we went in was Taranto.
I see.
Which was rather interesting, really, because Italy, as you know, threw in the towel.
Mm-hmm.
This was, I guess, the end of August.
Something like that, yeah.
And under great secrecy, the whole of my brigade was marshalled at Bizerta, I think. Yes, Bizerta was the place, yes. And we were loaded onto cruisers, of all things, naval cruisers. And the ship that I went on was the HMS Dido. And we put about 300 to 400 men on each of these cruisers. There was 5 or 6 of them, take the brigade, with no transport except hand carts. That's all we had, little kind of wheelbarrow things that you pulled along. And I think they took on 1 jeep per battalion for the CO, that was all.
Mm-hmm.
And we set off at night, and we went like the hammers of hell across the Mediterranean to Taranto, zigzagging the whole way to avoid submarines. But we were going at I guess 30, 35 knots the whole way, really flat out. Strange to say, as we were nearing Taranto, the whole of the Italian Navy, which had surrendered, sailed past quite close, and all dipped their ensigns to the British Navy, which was really rather amusing. But they were going into Valletta at Malta.
The sailors must have found this quite...
everybody cheered like hell. It was great.
Dido had been in the Mediterranean for several years, I think, studying him, yeah.
So, we got into Taranto, and was just about an hour before us, that a previous ship that had gone in, I forgot the name of it now, had the Welsh regiment on board, and hit a mine in the harbour. Mm-hmm. And quite a few of the chaps had got killed, actually, the soldiers on the thing, but... you know, it didn't hold up the flow, and we eventually got off this boat, and with our kit on our back, everything we had in the world on our back, we started marching. Mm-hmm. And that night we marched about 5 miles north of Taranto and started to dig in, and nobody seemed to know where the Germans were or what the hell was going on. And the next day, of course, we started sending out patrols to find out where the hell the Germans were. And we had one or two interesting things. The Germans, one party came down the road in a great big Mercedes car, and were absolutely astounded when they found themselves surrounded by British troops. And this German officer was obviously going into Taranto for a dirty weekend. He had a kind of suitcase and his pajamas and all the rest of it. And he was absolutely horrified that he was taken prisoner.
No, not that they didn't have any idea that you had arrived and seen it.
No. Mm-hmm. Then we started moving forward fairly rapidly once we found out where about the Germans were or what they were doing. And we moved up to the airfield at Foggia. And in fact, the Air Landing Brigade was the brigade that captured all the airfields at Foggia. Mm-hmm. And this was a great move forward, because it allowed our air forces to move in, because there were fairly extensive airfields there. Mm-hmm. And they could move in and start giving us very close support from then on.
Were you running into much opposition on this advance up to Foggia?
Not very much.
Not at all, right?
Mainly patrol activity. We had a bit of a battle south of Foggia, the German rear guard, but, you know, a little bit of shelling, nothing very serious. It was brushed aside. Unfortunately, of course, like all these damn things, people do get hurt and people get killed, but it wasn't certainly what you could call serious opposition. Mm-hmm. And we got into Foggia with really very little trouble. The Germans pulled out, and before any serious counterattacks were made by the Germans, we had handed over to 78th Div, and 78th Div took the pounding of the counterattacks. Mm-hmm. And we were pulled back, and then we were put on landing craft at Taranto again, I suppose, and we were sent to Philippeville. Mm-hmm. And there we awaited a ship to take us back to the UK, where we arrived before Christmas and started preparing for D-Day and what was to follow. One interesting thing that happened during the Foggia time was that my company were asked to do a kind of raid, I suppose. It was really a reconnaissance in force, just to see if there was any Germans about. And in fact, there weren't any, I don't think, to worry about. And anyway, the next morning, this was probably 48 hours before this thing was to take place, I felt desperately ill. I didn't know what the hell was wrong with me. And this little MO used to come round the companies. Mm-hmm. And he took one look at me, you see, and he said, Oh, he said, there's nothing wrong with you. You're perfectly all right. And I said, well, you may think so, but I don't think so. But anyway, what the hell can you say? You see? So I carried on. And the next day, for some reason or other, a different MO came round. And he took one look at me and he said, oh my God, he said, you've got jaundice. And I was immediately evacuated. And it's amazing this, I was evacuated all the way back down the line through all the various stages to Catania in Sicily, to a general hospital in Catania. And by the time I got back there, I was feeling as fit as a fiddle, because it took about 10 days to get back there. Mm-hmm. So anyway, when eventually I persuaded the powers that be that I was perfectly fit and I wanted to go back to my regiment, they released me from the hospital. And there was absolutely no arrangements for you to get back. See, the normal system was that you went to a reinforcement holding unit.
Mm-hmm.
And there you could have been sent anywhere. But I wanted to go back to my own regiment. So I started hitchhiking. I had the most extraordinary experience going all the way back by myself on Italian trains and goodness knows what, all the way up to Foggia, where the battalion was.
Mm-hmm.
Or just south of Foggia, actually. And it was really quite unique experience, having gone through that and realized that anybody who didn't particularly want to get back to their regiment, you know, could have gone anywhere. Nobody would have known.
That's a rather odd system. If you could have parachute training and ended up in an engineer unit.
That's right. Yeah.
Brother, yeah.
I was going to get a drink of water. Can you turn it off for a moment?
Sure. Make sure that doesn't roll off there. So, as you say, then back in England, you began your training for D-Day.
That's right. And at this stage, I was still with the Border Regiment in the Air Landing Brigade.
Mm-hmm. Did you know that you were actually training for the invasion of Europe, or was it just...
Well, one assumed that this was going to happen. I mean, there was nothing concrete, but we assumed this was going to happen. It was obviously that we'd been brought back to England for this purpose and for nothing, no other reason.
Yeah.
I guess about March, I had a little bit of a falling out with my CO in the Border Regiment, and he asked me if I would like to get a posting elsewhere, and I said under the circumstances probably be a good idea. And it was at this stage that the CO of this reconnaissance squadron, whom I knew quite well, Freddie Goff,
mm-hmm.
great old boy, said to me, would I like to come and be his adjutant?
Mm-hmm.
And I said I would love to, and so I was transferred from the Border Regiment to the reconnaissance corps and the reconnaissance squadron in the Airborne Division.
What was the purpose of the reconnaissance squadron? Well, reconnaissance, obviously, but... How were they supposed to operate in the event of an airborne landing?
Well, this is it was a completely unique unit in the British Army.
Mm-hmm.
The total strength was about 200 odd, all ranks. Very, very strong in officers. Every section was commanded by a lieutenant. And there were a total of 8 men in a section.
Mm-hmm.
Each section had 2 jeeps. And the jeeps had the Vickers K machine gun mounted on the front of the jeep, and each pair of jeeps had what was considered then a fairly high-powered radio set in it. In fact, it was the 21 or 22 set, I think it was called.
Mm-hmm.
We had 3 troops, each of 3 sections in a troop, so there was a total of 6 jeeps in a troop plus two headquarter jeeps, so a total of 8 jeeps per troop.
Mm-hmm.
So we had 3 of those, and then we had a support troop which consisted of 2 3-inch mortars and 2 it was really an Espana aircraft gun, really, but it was used in an anti-tank well. It was on wheels, and you could tow the thing behind a Jeep.
20 millimeters.
Yeah, 20 millimeters, yeah. That's right. And we had two of those. And then we had a kind of administrative troop, which basically didn't go to war with us, but brought up the kind of seaborne tail, the quartermaster and all these sort of people, paymaster and whatever. We had a fairly strong signal section, because we had a lot of communications, as you do in any kind of recce or armoured setup. Our role varied, of course. It was to provide reconnaissance in the normal way that it does in any division. In the case of the Battle of Arnhem, that was rather unique. We were the only unit in the whole of the division that was mobile, and therefore the role given to us was to land first, to get into our jeeps and hightail it down to the bridges, or the bridge over the Rhine, and hold the bridge until the infantry marched there and could take over from us. And in fact, that was our role at Arnhem.
The training must have been, if anything, even more intensive than it was in the Norway landing.
It was. We did a tremendous amount of field firing up on the Derbyshire Moors, mainly. We did very little, strange to say, formation exercises, divisional and brigade and that sort of thing. I think this was a great failing, certainly in peacetime. One did a certain amount of formation exercises, particularly in Germany with the British and that sort of thing. During the war, we seemed to do very few of exercises of kind of brigade, division, and even corps exercises. There were few and far between. And the result was that the brigade staffs and the divisional staffs, in my opinion, didn't get the training that they really needed.
The same appears to apply to the American parachute units as well. They did do large scale exercises.
I think that the men themselves and the sections and platoons and companies were super training, absolutely marvellous. But above that was rather lacking.
So when then did you get the first official word about the Normandy operation?
Well, at that time in England there were two British airborne divisions and two American. The Americans were the 82nd and the 101 Airborne Division, and the British were the 1st Division and the 6th Division. Now, on D-Day, the 6th Division, the 82nd and the 101 went to Normandy. The 1st Airborne Division was held in reserve, as Montgomery's strategic reserve.
You spent the time then basically waiting to see if you were going to be dropped somewhere after the landing.
Well, that's right.
Yeah.
In fact, we were briefed for, to my certain knowledge, at least 12 operations in the next couple of months. And on one occasion, we were actually airborne in the aircraft, had taken off, and the thing was cancelled, and we were called back.
What operation was that to have been?
We were going to be dropped north of Lille. We had very little preparation. It would have been a disaster, I think. But in fact, you see, what happened was that the British were advancing so quickly, so rapidly at this stage, that before you could plan an operation, our own troops had got there.
Because
an airborne operation, let's face it, takes a little bit of time to lay on, particularly when you're talking about divisions and this sort of thing. You see, there's a lot of men involved, a tremendous number of aircraft. We were briefed for one exercise at Caen, which would have been a terrible business. It would have been absolute slaughter, I think. We were going to be dropped behind two German armoured divisions to try and cut off their supplies whilst the British kind of pushed into Caen, but thank God it never came off. Anyway, these are the kind of things that we got involved in. And then, in September, early in September, we were briefed for the Arnhem battle. Mm-hmm. And initially, in some respects it's a great pity it didn't go ahead. Initially it was going to be the 1st Airborne Division only was going to do the whole thing. One brigade to drop at Arnhem, one brigade to drop at Nijmegen, and one brigade to drop in the Grave area.
Mm-hmm.
And this was planned for 1 week or even 2 weeks, I think, before the actual battle take place.
Yeah.
Had this happened, the chances are the Germans would have been so unprepared at that stage that we might have got away with it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, whereas by delaying it for two more weeks so that the three divisions could take part in the thing,
yeah.
Although we had much more manpower, the Germans were that much better prepared and were able to counter it much more effectively than they would have been able to had we had dropped 2 weeks before.
I gather some of the SS units that were at Arnhem only arrived a few days before you did yourself.
That's right.
Yeah. Why was the operation changed? Why did you feel that?
Because I think that I think Montgomery probably, I'm not sure of my facts here, but I presume that Montgomery felt that one division wouldn't be enough to do the job. And at that stage, Eisenhower, if you remember, had given his approval to this operation, and at the same time had said, and you can also have the use of two airborne divisions, American.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Montgomery thought this was a wonderful opportunity to make a real big show of it.
Yeah.
But I think he didn't take into account that there weren't enough aircraft to lift all three divisions in one go, whereas there were enough aircraft to lift the one division in one go, you see.
There has been, this may be a question you might not want to answer, but there's been a lot of criticism leveled both at Montgomery and at General Frederick Browning for the way they planned the operation. Do you think that that's justified? Saying that it was sloppily planned, the intelligence reports were nowhere near up to date enough, this sort of thing. Did you find that that was the case?
Well, of course, I mean, you've got to remember, I was only a junior officer at the time. I was adjutant of the recce squadron, and we really weren't in the know as far as kind of this sort of thing was, what was going on at the divisional level or the corps level and this sort of thing.
What I meant really was, did you feel comfortable about the operation when you went into it? Like,
oh, absolutely. There was no hesitation whatsoever. We felt that by then, you see, we had the general impression that the Germans were damnedly beaten anyway, and it was going to be a piece of cake.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the general feeling that we went in, that there wasn't going to be really too much trouble at all.
Mm-hmm.
We were certainly given a very different opinion when he eventually got down on the ground, I think.
Yeah.
But this is the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I think Browning, whom I have met, whom I have spoken to, was a very fine soldier.
Mm-hmm.
I think that he was probably lacking a little in operational experience at the kind of higher level.
Mm-hmm.
May have been a little bit hasty, but you see, you must also remember that at that stage this division had been briefed, as I said, 12 times, and you know, everybody said, what the bloody hell's going on, sort of thing, you know, let's get on with it, something, mm-hmm. we've got to get on with it. And I think that Browning was felt this feeling among the troops, and he said, well, whatever happens, we're going to go into this, you see, regardless of what the intelligence is, sort of thing, we'll be able to overcome it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Urquhart, on the other hand, was a fairly experienced soldier. That was the divisional commander.
Mm-hmm.
A man whom I've spoken to on two or three occasions. A very sound soldier, I think, I think he made one dreadful mistake, but it wasn't altogether his mistake, I don't think, and that is by landing the division 8 miles from the objective.
Mm-hmm.
If we had landed even a brigade on the bridge, or close to the bridge, I think they would have held the bridge without any trouble whatsoever. But the Air Force, at that stage, had turned around and said, we cannot land anybody near the bridge because the anti-aircraft fire is too heavy, is too great. And that was one of the main deciding factors in moving the whole landing zone 6 to 8 miles away from the bridge, mm-hmm. which of course turned out to be an absolute disaster.
Yeah. So, okay, you received your briefing for this in September and sort of went into your last minute preparation, last minute training.
There wasn't so much training at that stage. I mean, any training we'd done had been done.
Mm-hmm.
It was a question of loading gliders, and it was a very complicated business, really. And as adjutant, it was my job to work out these load tables, which had to be terribly accurate, exactly how many troops and vehicles went in every aircraft, which was allotted to us.
Mm-hmm.
And the gliders took off from an airfield way down in the south near Bournemouth, town Rushton, I think it was they went to, whereas the parachute party, which was I guess 80%, 85% of the unit were jumped by parachute, and it was only the vehicles that went by glider.
Mm-hmm.
They took off from another airfield entirely different in Lincolnshire, you see. So you had the split of the unit for a start,
mm-hmm.
and then we married up at the other end.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this all had to be carefully arranged, and timings had to be made, and convoys, the vehicles had to all go by convoy down to Bournemouth. We were stationed near Grantham in Lincolnshire, and it was a fairly long drive. This all had to be arranged. We had to move all the troops into a secure area so that they couldn't talk to their girlfriends or sweethearts or anything, and they were behind barbed wire 48 hours before we took off.
Mm-hmm.
This was all for security, of course, but this was a fairly complicated business, and it all had to be very carefully looked into and carefully worked out. Anyway, the great day came, and we moved to this airfield, which was, I think it was called Branston Heath in Lincolnshire, on the Sunday morning. We got there, I guess, about 10 o'clock, and we were allotted to our aircraft, and eventually loaded, and we were in a Dakota, pulled by Americans, and off we went.
Mm-hmm.
It was a really super trip over, and the weather was good. We had no interference from the enemy whatsoever, flak or anything, a little bit of flak in the distance, nothing to worry about. We were surrounded by fighter aircraft, both American and British, all the way. And the landing was just like an exercise. It was just absolutely superb. A brilliant sunny afternoon, and we landed perfectly. There were some minor accidents. Sergeant Major broke his back, I think. And, we lost a few vehicles in the gliders when they crashed.
Mm-hmm.
But generally speaking, it was a pretty successful landing. We married up. With I came in by parachute, and the like everybody else did, except for the drivers with the vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
We married up, and we started on our way to Arnhem. Well, we hadn't gone very far, a little village called Wolfhazen, before the leading section ran into heavy German fire, and the section commander was killed, and three other men in the section were killed, and we opened up on the enemy with mortar fire and this sort of thing and tried to find a way around. We couldn't. By then, the 1st Battalion, Parachute Battalion, had come up behind us and were going through us. And the CO said that he would push on through the Germans, which he did, and they took a number of the Germans prisoners. And then my CO, Fredikoff, said, I'm going to go to divisional headquarters to find out what the divisional commander wants me to do now that we have been stopped going forward. Stay here until I get back. So I held the squadron up where it was, and the CO pushed off, and I never saw him again until after the war. In fact, when he got to divisional headquarters, the divisional commander had left to go and find one brigade. Fredikoff went after him. He never found the divisional commander. He got hooked up with one brigade and eventually got down to the bridge with his jeep, and he had his IO with him, and he had another jeep load of soldiers with him. We were left with the squadron without a CO, and it was 6 o'clock that night, I guess, or 5 o'clock anyway, before the G1 from the division called me in and told me what had happened. And a fellow called David Allsop, who was the senior captain, took over. And the next day we tried again on another route to get through to the bridge, and ran into a lot of trouble. And eventually, as you are probably well aware, the battle formed into a sort of perimeter or a bridgehead, and we were allotted a section of this perimeter, and there we stayed for the next 7 days, undergoing some of the most bitter fighting I've ever seen, and I guess the most bitter fighting a lot of people have ever seen. The casualties were terrible. Eventually, what was left of us were told to withdraw, and I think it was the 9th day or the 10th day after being there. 9th day, I think. And the lucky ones that were still alive and was unwounded got ourselves down to the river, there were some kind of landing craft with little outboard motors that run by Canadian engineers, strange to say, who eventually got us across the Rhine and down the line to Nijmegen, and eventually to an airfield near Eindhoven, and then we were flown back to England.
Gough, I seem to recall, remained down there at the bridgehead. He was stuck down there and was captured,
right,
along with all the rest of the
Ross
people.
That's right.
Yeah. And Urquhart ended up getting stuck in a house with the Germans.
That's right. Yeah.
I understand that there was a lot of confusion on the first day of the landing. Apparently the radio sets weren't functioning.
Well, that was a great problem.
Yeah.
The radio sets were not very efficient in those days. Nothing like they are today.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition to that, we had been allotted a frequency which was the same frequency as the local radio station.
Okay.
This sort of thing can happen. How were they to know?
Exactly, yeah.
And on top of that, for some reason or other, and God knows what it was, but something ran on them in the built-up area, these radio sets really were as good as useless.
Mm-hmm.
They just would not work. And we had virtually no communication by radio. It all had to be done by runner.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, when in a fast-moving battle like that, it just doesn't work.
Yeah.
Had we had good communications, things would have been entirely different. Mm-hmm. So communications were absolutely vital in any battle. In this particular case, the communications completely broke down. And were never really established. Eventually a link was established between divisional headquarters and corps headquarters in Nijmegen, but that took, I think, 2 or 3 days to do that.
Mm-hmm. Who was the reconnaissance squadron taking orders from throughout most of this time?
Well, we came directly under division.
I see. Yeah.
Until we got into the perimeter, and we were allotted our section in the perimeter, and then we came under General Hackett.
Mm-hmm.
See, Hackett was one of the brigade commanders, and he was allotted one side, and what was the name of the other chap, the landing brigade? Pip Hicks.
Mm-hmm.
Hicks was allotted the other side. Mm-hmm. And we came under one of these chaps. You see, they sorted it out among themselves. We saw a bit of Shannon Hackett. In fact, I was very close to him when he was blown up when this mortar bomb landed on his jeep and killed his BM and severely wounded him. And I don't know if you read the book that he wrote about...
I Was a Stranger of
He's a marvellous man, Hackett. Very, very intelligent little man and very fine soldier.
Mm-hmm.
Hicks was also a pretty solid citizen. He got away without being wounded. Amazing, really, because the extraordinary thing was with these older, they weren't all that old, but they seemed old to us, I suppose, senior officers. They seemed to walk around with shellfire going like bloody hell and never seemed to bat an eyelid. I couldn't understand it at all. I thought they were terribly brave, but maybe they had a bit more guts than I had. I don't remember.
Maybe they felt it was expected of a general.
Well, that's right. I think they did.
Memories of the First World War with a general always walking upright in the trenches.
That's so right. So anyway, we got through that business. When we got back to England, I found myself to be the senior officer left in the squadron. What was left? We brought 32 men out of 200.
That's all. Yeah. What had happened to chap David Alsop?
He got wounded.
I see.
He got out, but he was wounded and in hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So I had this terrible job of writing all these letters to these next of kin.
Mm-hmm.
And believe you me, I was only a young man myself, 23, 24. And I had this awful job writing these letters, and really, when I didn't know half the people, you know, very well, it's very, very difficult to write a letter.
Yeah.
But one had to do it, and we did it. And then, of course, the awful job came of writing up people for decorations and things. And I found this extremely difficult because I'd had no previous experience of it, really.
Mm-hmm.
And the result was that the 4-0 squadron, who really fought terribly well, and some very, very brave men among them, we came off rather badly as far as gongs were concerned.
Oh, yeah.
Because of my inability to write up these things very well, which was rather unfortunate. Had Freddie Goff come back, I'm sure that he would have pressed for much more than I was able to do, you see, because he had a lot of friends in court and this sort of thing.
So the entire division pretty much needed to be rebuilt from this point.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, it was at that stage that I guess we were told unofficially that the chances of the division ever going into battle again were pretty damn remote, because we'd been so cut about.
Yeah.
And it was at that stage that I applied for a staff job with the 14th Army in the Far East.
Mm-hmm.
I was accepted, and I've sent on a course at Wimbledon, kind of staff course for about 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was sent out to India, and eventually on to Burma.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd been in Burma about 3 months doing a staff job with a brigadier, and I was asked if I'd like to be seconded to the Burma police and reform one of these frontier battalions.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was the kind of job that I look forward to and loved, because I didn't like sitting in a chair all day doing staff work. And so I went to Barmo, and there I took over these 50-odd Kachins, I suppose, who were in rags. A few of them had rifles, and they gave me an establishment of, I think it was 800-odd men.
Mm-hmm.
And they said there's so many thousands and thousands of rupees in the treasury for you to draw on for their wages, and this is the wage scale, and this sort of thing, and this is the establishment. We'll be back in 6 months to see how you're getting on. You see.
Had you got a promotion at this time as well?
I was a major, yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so I went to town, and I absolutely loved it, and I brought this battalion up to about 750. We built barracks. I had six outposts on the Chinese frontier manned.
Mm-hmm.
We've got uniforms for them, rifles for them, and tremendous fun. I learnt the language reasonably well. And after all this, and I thought that I'd got a job for the rest of my life, which I was going to love, the British decided to pull out of Burma. And of course, all British officers had to go. And by then, of course, they had asked me whether I wanted to stay with the police or come back in the army, and I said, I love this job, I want to stay with the police, you see. So I could not any longer go back to the army, because then I was a policeman, officially, although I didn't do any police work, really. And so I couldn't go back to the British Army. By then they were running down, and they didn't want anybody, you know. And so I started looking for a job, and somebody said, would you like to do a job in southern Burma, rubber planting? And I said, yes, I'd love to do it. And so I had 6 months leave, went home to England, came back again, and started running this rubber estate in, down the Tenasserim Peninsula.
Mm-hmm.
But by then the British had pulled out, and law and order in Burma was disintegrating.
Mm-hmm.
It was really terrible. A lot of corruption going on. And the good old reliable kind of police NCOs, which we had trained, which the British had trained, were rapidly kicked out.
Mm-hmm.
And replaced by God knows what.
Yeah.
And so it became so bad that I wrote to the firm in London and said, there's no point in carrying this on. You're going to lose money. They're stealing half your profits. And,
mm-hmm.
and so they flew out from England, and they said, what was I going to do? And I said, I was going to Ceylon in India. I'd been offered a job on a tea estate. And they said, well, we'll double your salary if you take over a estate in Malaya. So I said, that sounds pretty good. So I went down to Malaya.
just a moment, if I could. You went into all this. You seem to be very blasé about this, coming from being a parachutist into running a plantation in the Far East. Did you?
Really, no problem.
Yeah?
It's man management, you know. It's man management, administration, really. The technical side of planting is, you can learn very quickly. I mean, you can read the book. It's just like gardening, really. Like,
yeah.
You know. The man management side of it was the important thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, in Burma, in Malaya, same sort of thing went on. I was an assistant manager there. It was a very big estate, about 3,000 acres, and there was a kind of senior manager, and I was an assistant.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed it. Up in Kelantan, near Kota Bharu.
Mm-hmm.
And then I met my wife. Mm-hmm. We got married in Singapore, and the bandit trouble was going full blast. And in Kelantan it was particularly bad.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided that it was no place to have a young wife with all this trouble going on, and particularly we were out in the sticks, and the bungalow was surrounded by the police at night, you know, guarding us, and it really was not a very pleasant business. And so we decided to pack up.
Mm-hmm.
And we came to Canada in April 51, April, May 51. By June, I had joined the PBCLI, and by September I was on the way to Korea with a company of the PBCLI, and I ended up commanding C Company.
Mm-hmm.
Of the 1st Battalion of PBCLI.
I'm going to, we're just about out of tape on this side. I'm going to have to take a few minutes of your time on the other side, and we'll sort of do Korea there.